Well, he was instrumental in bringing us the incredible story of the face on Mars, our science advisor and head of the EnterpriseMission.com, Richard C. Hoagland, with us now as we will talk about all things space on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, if I told you everything about Richard Hoagland's bio, we'd spend half the night talking about the things that he has done. You can follow him on Facebook. His website is EnterpriseMission.com. I will tell you he is the author of several books out there, including Dark Mission, that he wrote with Mike Barra, and also Monuments of Mars as well. And tonight, Richard's back with us for a full program. Are you ready to go, Richard?
No, give me another half hour.
Yeah, no, you're ready. You've got a clock in your head, my friend.
Good evening, George. Actually, it's morning here. It's evening your time.
Well, thank you, by the way, for the updates that you've been giving us over the past week on the various space issues.
I want to say something about that, and I'm doing this at the behest of certain people who are literally risking their lives. And I want to underscore that. We live, as you were just discussing with Jerome, in an extremely fractured society. This planet is not one. It is falling apart in every imaginable direction. So how can I be optimistic? Well, stay tuned for the rest of the 3 hours, and you'll find out a few things. The people who have been providing me this information, sources, remember how I do not like to depend on sources? I depend on sources when those individuals, those very brave men and women who step forward and provide us with key data, are supported and documented and confirmed by the independent evidence which we assemble ourselves. And hopefully tonight, we got 3 hours, we're going to go through some very specific instances of where a lot of folks have kind of gotten off the rails thinking we said one thing when we have not actually said that thing. We've said something much more nuanced, much more in keeping with how the intelligence agencies analyze the world or the president or, you know, the Soviet counterparts, et cetera, et cetera. We're trying to figure out what's going on in space as it affects and could affect and will affect people living here on Earth. It's like the old, you know, cliche that you don't spend a dime in space, you spend it all on Earth to get into space.
That's right.
Well, the information I'm providing comes at a cost. There are people who have taken courageously to providing me data that I provide to you and others.
Over the years.
And they are documentably confirmed tonight in several incredibly interesting areas, some of which you and I, not to tell tales out of school, but we've had our, shall we say, friendly disagreements.
Mm-hmm.
You have not always agreed with me. That's
correct.
Perfectly fine. I hope you agree that I'm trying to do the best professional job to provide this audience with the best professional information. And I try not to lead people in the wrong direction by saying, this will happen. You'll hear that I almost never say something will happen. The only time I ever said something will happen is when I said President Barack Obama would become the president, and I thereby won my show, which I'm still going to collect at some point.
Well, if it's including interest, you'll probably get 8 shows by now.
Anyway, what I'm going to talk about tonight is to try to knit some of these dots together, courtesy of the brave men and women who have provided me some very recent, very revealing and insightful new information. So where do you want to start?
Well, let give me an update, first of all, on this incredible story of this Russian craft that's supposed to go to Phobos, Mars's moon, and it should have been pulled into the Earth by now. What's going on with this thing?
Well, the latest information is that even the insiders, who, again, I'm getting access to because of these brave people, they don't know. And, George, if they don't know, and we're talking a network of people who are in the decision-making loops, then it would be very, you know, the height of hubris for me to claim that I know. So what I want to do is I want to lay out some scenarios for everybody understanding just because we say something might be possible or might have happened, we're not married to this idea. We could get new data tomorrow that would toss that idea out and replace it with solid facts. So do they even know
where it is, Richard? And the reason I ask you that is we can track 3 inches of debris up there.
I heard you say that to Jerome, and with one small caveat. We had two major satellite, bus-size satellites, fall out of the sky in the last couple of months.
That's right.
And nobody at this moment knows where they went?
They think, but they're not sure.
Well, they either think or they know and are not telling us, mm-hmm. which oddly enough fits into some of these scenarios we're going to talk about tonight. The point is that a lot of things that are known on the inside are not deemed appropriate for us on the outside to ever know. We have been handled like children. That's why when you look around this planet tonight, George, we're in deep trouble, or as President George Herbert Walker Bush used to say, deep doo-doo, because we're being treated like children.
Actually,
it's even worse. We're being treated like cattle, like slaves, like people who don't have a brain, who should never think outside the box, who should only do what they're told and never ask a question. And that's what's getting us into a terrible position, whereas I've been saying to some of my friends lately, unless a game changer appears or is specifically allowed to happen or created, this planet in every facet is in deep trouble from down here to up there. Now, a lot of people ask me, well, why are you so concerned with what's out there when it doesn't, that's not going to mean a damn thing to me? Let's say we discover life on Mars. Why the hell should I care? Well, how is it possibly going to affect my life? And what I'm hoping to do tonight is to lay out the case, George, that the stuff that's going on out there is going to have history-changing effects and impacts on everyday people's lives down here. And no lesser a personage than John Fitzgerald Kennedy laid that scenario out 40-some years ago. Why do you think, in the midst of all kinds of crises, including a major confrontation almost on a daily basis, ranging from Berlin to Cuba to, you know, anywhere else in the Far East with the Soviet Union, John Kennedy decided one afternoon he was going to send us to the moon? How is the moon possibly relevant to solving the crises of Earth that in many speeches he absolutely said, you know, could do in the human race, could produce the extinction of the human species? Because he knew, and I'm hoping we can lay out a case this evening, that we will all know that what goes on out there and the forces that are at bay vying for our future, for control of our future on this planet, have to be addressed, have to be confronted, and have to be surmounted if there is going to be a viable lifestyle for middle-class Americans or average people all over this planet, 7 billion of us, who are not the 1%. I find it stunningly intriguing that this whole new Occupy movement has arisen apparently out of nowhere, actually growing out of decades of neglect and increasing subjugation that people...
Social networking, Richard.
...are finally beginning to come aware of. And yes, the social networks are allowing people to talk to each other in ways they've never been able to talk before. That's why when someone this week told me, one of my inside, you know, sources, that he was extremely concerned that we were going to have a major face-off with the Russians. You know, we have two aircraft carrier battle
yeah.
groups that are meeting in the Eastern Mediterranean.
Yeah.
The battle That's group right. around the U.S. carrier, you know, the George Bush, and a carrier battle group commanded by the Admiral, I forget the Russian's name, aircraft carrier, that's coming down from the north through the various waterways to get to the Eastern Med right off Syria. It's like that's a flashpoint.
This has got all the makings of a Hollywood movie.
It has
it?
All the makings of a confrontation.
Yeah.
And what I said to him, and it was so interesting because one of the ways I gauge the honesty of my sources is if they actually can contain and carry a new thought that's not part of their 20, 30, 40-year, you know, Cold War programming. I said, but, and I won't mention his name, this time each of the sailors on both of those carrier groups are all on Facebook and Twitter. They're talking to each other.
Yeah.
This is not the height of the Cold War.
Yeah.
And that's what makes this so stunningly different. So as part of the discussion tonight, I will raise the possibility that what we're seeing in the Eastern Med is actually very artful misdirection. that has nothing to do with real confrontation.
I hope you're right on that one, too.
Well, we will see. Right. But again, I am talking to people all over the world, and I'm sure you are, too, that literally are getting up to listen to this program when everybody else here in the United States is going to bed. That's how far around the world this program now reaches.
Yeah, it's and it's growing.
Back to your question, what's going on with the Soviet mission? I keep calling it the Soviet mission because it grew out of the Soviet...
Well, I understand, but I can't understand why they just don't say, we can't get these two engines going, we can't get their engines set up, we can't go to Mars. And isn't that window now gone?
The window is essentially gone, although even there I think we're being artfully lied to. Both sides, and I'm going to talk about two sides here kind of simplistically, the Russians and the Americans. Both sides have essentially the same primitive, stupid, Newtonian-based rocket technology to, in public programs, get to Mars, right?
Public programs, I agree.
It's called chemical rockets. We have some slightly more expensive, slightly more sophisticated versions. The Russians use tried-and-true kind of battleship-grade hardware, and theirs is very reliable. Ours sometimes is not quite so reliable, but we both basically are using chemical rockets, so there isn't a huge disparity in the weight of the payload you can carry to another planet using that technology. Both missions, the Curiosity rover mission that NASA launched a few days ago successfully, and the Russian Phobos Grunt mission, which is still stuck in low Earth orbit, and we'll get to the details momentarily, basically use chemical propulsion to send about a ton payload to Mars. With that as kind of your ground rules, how come the Russian window to go to Mars opened 2 weeks earlier than the American window and closed 2 weeks earlier?
Isn't it the same window?
No.
It should be, right?
It should be.
Yeah.
Right there, it doesn't take, well, yes, it does take a rocket scientist to figure out somebody is lying.
That reminds me of the day I got a call from someone who said, from the West Coast, and here I am in the Midwest, and they said, George, I wish you were out here in L.A. right now where you could see this incredible full moon. And they actually thought I saw like a half a moon in St. Louis.
Well, those are people that don't know how to use Google.
No.
Google is your friend. So anyway, that's the first weirdness that I discovered, which was, wait a minute, the Russian window is 2 weeks different than the American. That's not possible, given it's essentially the same technology, plus or minus a few bells and whistles.
And it's the same window.
Yeah. So that brings us to the next interesting possibility. Did the Russians launch the night of November 9th, their time, November 8th, our time, to put this thing deliberately into Earth orbit and to keep it there in a parking orbit waiting for the real window to open?
And that's possible.
And if they did that, why wouldn't they tell everybody?
Yeah.
Well, maybe the mission as advertised by the Russians is not the real mission. And they're trying a very interesting level of misdirection that has only been seen back during the Cold War. And you've got all kinds of other weirdnesses, like the day after they found this thing. Remember, we broke the story. Hours ahead, Coast was first on the planet broadcast media to report the Russians, with the help of the Europeans, had found their spacecraft after 2 weeks of dead silence. And you read that on the air. And Linda yelped, and she said, oh, my God, because she instantly got what this meant, that something else is going on. The something else, I think, tonight, and again, this is a scenario. This is not fact. This is an informed speculation, putting together all the dots.
This is you weaving what you can see with these pieces of a puzzle.
Based on inputs from a variety of sources, including human intelligence, HUMINT, as they call it. I think the Russians are artfully waiting for the real window that they have eschewed going to Mars, going to Phobos, going anywhere near that inner moon, that in fact they have either long-term planned to do this, and this has been a hell of a shaggy dog story to lead everybody else astray, all the potential enemies that might try to stop them, and we'll get to who they might be in a moment.
Okay.
they made a last-minute decision, a command decision at the highest levels, you know, at the level of Putin and Medvedev, and this was a backup to something the U.S. did that they are responding to without wanting the rest of the world to know anything about what they're secretly up to, and they've been basically stringing all of us along with this soap opera over the last couple, 3 weeks about a missing and, you know, dying spacecraft, et cetera, et cetera. As we said the other night, George, you don't have a spacecraft which is dead if it's lifting itself out of the atmosphere and keeping itself from reentering.
That's right. It comes down. It doesn't keep going up.
God and gravity says it's got to come down.
That's
it, right. Can't go up by itself. In fact, there was one really kooky story where someone was claiming that the solar panels were acting like wings and boosting it up. I mean, you talk about disinformation or throwing enough spaghetti on the wall so nobody could figure out their way through the thicket of disinformation to the clues.
Why would the Russians want to even go to Phobos?
Well, because Phobos is an artificial spacecraft. It's not a moon. It is an unnatural object containing extraordinary historical and geopolitical and scientific and every other breakthrough you can imagine. And they've known this since 1989. How did they know this? They sent a mission, the Soviets, back when Russia was the Soviet Union, the head of the empire. They sent a mission to Mars called Phobos 1 and 2, a two-part mission. They lost the first spacecraft, they said, due to a programming error at the control center in Moscow. And if you believe that one, there's a bridge I've got that right out here in Arizona that's real cheap. The other spacecraft got to Mars, Phobos 2, went into orbit, took a lot of remarkable observations of the surface showing very strange artificial-looking patterns in the infrared, and then it nudged itself over to an orbit that eventually would have wound up cozying right up to Phobos, and en route in the last few hundred miles, something happened, and it disappeared.
That was where, didn't they have a shot, there was a photograph of some kind of shadowy figure coming at it?
It wasn't a shadowy figure. That was supposedly the shadow on the surface was the shadow of that figure. It actually turned out to be an artifact of the way they were taking photographs. That was the shadow of Phobos itself, because the cameras were not like framing cameras. They were like facsimile cameras.
Mm-hmm.
Back when we had fax, remember how you used to have fun? You'd pull the paper out before the machine would give it to you.
Yeah.
And everything would be distorted on the piece of paper. When you photograph a moving satellite like Phobos' shadow on Mars with a fax-type camera, you get a smeared, elliptical, elongated shadow. So that's not the interesting object. The interesting object appeared in the last frame of the picture sent from Phobos to Earth to the Russian ground station, and it looked like a giant, elongated, pencil-shaped spaceship.
Coming at it.
Coming right at it.
Yeah.
Which, of course, the Russians gleefully spread all over the planet. They actually sent a cosmonaut to appear at various UFO conferences to talk this story up. Total disinformation, as my late friend Tom Van Flandern elegantly proved one day, and I won't go into the details. It's somewhere on his website, metaresearch.com. If you want to go and find, you know, Tom's exquisite analysis of why the object around Phobos was not an alien spaceship, but in fact a piece of Phobos, go to his website, which is still being maintained, metaresearch.com, and Google, you know, Van Flandern Phobos analysis, and you'll probably find it somewhere there.
We're going to come back with Richard Hoagland. He's with us for the entire night on Coast to Coast AM. Now, Richard Hoagland has sent us some images that we've got posted for you at coasttocoastam.com. You might want to take a look at them when you get a moment as you follow along with us tonight. We'll be back with Richard and much more on Coast to Coast AM. So, Richard, this Mars mission, if it's not going to Mars, this Soviet craft, this Russian craft, where's it going?
I think YU-55. And I'm not
Which
the
is the
one.
Asteroid, right?
The asteroid. I'm not the only one. Again, sources are telling me from their independent analysis that that is the only reasonable option left for a fake mission which has been loitering in low Earth orbit and deliberately excluding any other communication from its so-called partners, i.e. the Europeans. Remember, the sequence that we put together a couple weeks ago after they found this thing after 2 weeks, it was a ESA ground station, a European Space Agency ground station in Perth, Australia, that on the 23rd, which was a Tuesday, which was, what, a week and a couple of days ago?
Yes.
Suddenly heard this signal from a spacecraft that was thought by the whole world, including you, to be totally dead, coming back in. And they picked up a radio transmission. And then on the next orbit, they picked up another one. So the Russians sent them a set of codes to beam up to the spacecraft to, quote, help them regain control. As soon as the Europeans beamed up those codes, nobody ostensibly could ever hear the thing again. That was a week ago. My sources are telling me that what the Russians did is send up codes to basically have their spacecraft change frequencies so no one else can know where to listen in. But the thing is still, from all the tracking data, maintaining its orbit, actually increasing its orbit by 10 miles from 3 weeks ago to now. So it appears to be marking time, stabilized in attitude, periodically firing its little jets to keep it from dipping into the atmosphere and coming home in a fiery mess, as if it is waiting for something.
What if it's been commandeered by someone else?
Well, that would be an extraordinary scenario, and then the question is who? Now, what's really intriguing is that in the midst of all this mystery, we have another one. The Russians have taken to posting on their websites to the point where our websites, like space.com, are picking up and quoting their generals saying these things. They're accusing, as I said in my last update, the CIA of taking out their mission with high-powered radar in Alaska, i.e. what they call the Western Climate Control Weapon, HARP.
Interesting.
This is the Russians claiming, you know, they got the same technology. They've had it, according to Tom Bearden, for like 30 years. They're claiming we're doing something that they have been accused by us at some times of doing. The point is, this all appears to be a great distraction. You know, left-hand, right-hand magic kind of stuff.
It's getting stranger and stranger.
Isn't it exquisite? Because if they really are going to pull this little cute trick where they don't send the Phobos grunt mission, remember, 14 tons of spacecraft, 13 of which are fuel, that's a huge amount of fuel, George. Why that much fuel? Well, to do the original mission, they would have required fuel to launch out of Earth orbit, and then fuel to slow down when they got to Mars to go into Mars orbit, because you can't use aerobraking because they don't go anywhere near the atmosphere, and then more fuel to rendezvous with the inner moon Phobos. That's very energy expensive in terms of primitive chemical rocket fuel. However, if they're waiting for the right celestial mechanics to line up, so they send this, you know, 15-ton spacecraft to our own moon, make a left-hand turn, a gravity slingshot around the moon at the right distance, re-vector their trajectory so it's heading out toward where YU-55 is, which, by the way, tonight is kind of pacing us off our stern. It's about 1.5 million miles away. Just kind of, you can't see it because it's too tiny and dim, but it's out there. I could run you the JPL applet, and you can see where it is.
And you're going to have to tell us why they would want to go there.
Oh, because YU-55 is artificial. It's another spacecraft. How do we know that?
How do we?
Because it was linked mathematically with an old friend of yours and mine called Elenine. Remember, I have been talking all summer into the fall that something big was going down related to this absolutely nothing little speck called Elenine that for some reason became the cause celeb all over the web and YouTube with the most humongous fear porn against its appearance. And people looked to the skies and they went out with telescopes and binoculars and they waited and they waited and they saw absolutely nothing. So they all got very mad at me. Because I never promised them a rose garden. I never said it was going to do anything. I said the message of Elohim is in the damn mathematics. If you can't speak the language of mathematics, you were deaf, dumb, and blind when it came to the
passage. This is the comment we thought was breaking up, right?
Well, that's one of the stories, one of the disinfo stories. I actually had a guy named Francis Walsh in Texas who managed to get imagery of Elohim after it is supposedly broken up, before it disappeared into the twilight with a robotic telescope in Australia, and he sent me the actual FTP images. And it showed the same thing that the NASA satellite showed of Elohim about a month before. There was this huge tetrahedral geometry somehow around this object called Elohim standing off the solar wind. And then it went away, and when it came out from in front of the sun into the evening skies, into the morning skies for us here in North America, nobody could see anything. And everybody gave up and said, it's a non-event. Not really. How many spacecraft that we and the Russians and the Europeans that are out in the solar system right now have you ever seen photographed, George?
Not a lot.
None. They're too damn tiny. You can't photograph them from Earth. No. You know they're there because they're sending radio signals.
And they you can see the ISS, but
that's in Earth orbit.
Yeah,
that's just upstairs. If you're very tall, you can reach up and touch it practically. I'm talking stuff in interplanetary space between Jupiter and Mars and Venus and Mercury. We have tons of spacecraft all over the solar system tonight, human missions, all of them feverishly sending back terabytes of data. Not one of them is visible. How do we know they're artificial? Because they have artificial, mathematically defined orbits.
Where did they come from?
We sent them. We're talking the current ones or the ancient ones?
Well, let's say like YU-55.
Well, YU-55, again, this is a scenario. This is a model. This is not yet fact. This is a best guesstimate based on the data we've been analyzing. It's part of a fleet of ancient spacecraft of humongous size that are probably relics of the ancient solar system war that occurred millions of years ago, that are part of the reconstruction of real solar system history that I and several other colleagues have been working on, like Joseph Farrell, for decades. We're getting close to where we might actually be able someday to publish a coherent model of what happened before, during, and after the war.
When did this happen?
Millions of years ago.
Millions of years.
My best guesstimate is 65 million years ago, and if that sounds vaguely familiar, it's because that's when something almost did in the dinosaurs here.
Whatever it was.
Whatever it was. If you look at the NASA data, and even the ESA data, and the Soviet data, grading into the Russian data, you can find really interesting clues in all of that data, basically in public domain. The only reason that there's only a few of us doing this and thinking seriously about it is because most people are waiting patiently, less and less patiently, for the magic day of disclosure when the president, Obama or some other, or the president of Russia, Medvedev or some other, or the Queen of England or the Pope or some big authority figure will sit down behind a big desk, look into the camera and say, "My fellow Earthlings, we are not alone." Now, you've said on this show you think that's never going to happen, that there is no
from government
for government.
From government, yeah.
Ever tell us the truth about this, right?
Yep.
Okay.
I'm not backing down on that.
Up until recently, I was kind of on that same page with you. As I'm going to lay out later this evening, there's now some interesting new data that indicates that policy might be about to change.
You're going to join Steve Bassett's camp, aren't you?
Not exactly, because I believe that for the last several years there has been a third forcing function introduced into that stalemate. And it's the forcing function which is forcing disclosure at some point in the terrestrial political game.
Well, I've always said if we get disclosure, it'll come from another source.
It has to be forced from outside because there's nothing. And this is where Steve and I have had real debates because every election he has hopes. His beating heart beats faster that this guy is going to be the guy.
Yeah.
And he's been thinking that for decades. Now, that's not to put Steve down, because I like Steve. I respect
He's got
Steve's
a true
work.
Passion for this.
He has the same commitment for his areas that I have for mine and other
that's
people
right.
have for theirs.
That's right.
I think he's analyzed this wrong. He said to me one time, he said, but Dick, if I didn't think that, I couldn't get up in the morning. In other words, no one can go to work thinking that what they're doing is pointless.
I understand.
And he believes that his efforts are going to, at some point, make a difference. Well, they have. I think they have created a context where this, we'll call it an external impetus, can actually be taken more seriously. And what he's done, what Steve and his colleagues in that movement have done, is they have alerted a large cross-section of the citizenry to the potentials and the upside and the extraordinary benefits to be gained from disclosure. I mean, as long as we're all kept in the dark, as long as none of us get what this could mean to redefining human civilization and creating a humane planet as opposed to the one we currently live on, then there's no political upside, even if they're being forced to tell us the truth. They'll try to tell us some god-awful lie and try to get away with it.
Of course. Well,
only by holding their feet to the fire that we can get a semblance of the truth, and that's going to be very important later on in our discussion this morning.
I agree with you wholeheartedly, Richard, that one, we're not alone in the universe, coining a phrase from Walter Sullivan, the late New York Times science writer. So and the fact that you believe that maybe 65 million years ago, there might have been some kind of celestial war out there, that's possible. 65 million years ago, though it might seem like a long time to us, is nothing in terms of space-time.
Nope.
It's nothing. It's a drop in the bucket. And I could imagine, you know, civilizations 65 million years old with incredible technology in a universe that's 14 billion years old, and that maybe, just maybe, they did have wars up there. You know, wars that, according to Ed Grimsley, are still continuing. So that's possible. I can't say to you, oh, Richard, I don't believe YU-55 is artificial or craft. It's possible. I mean, I remember as a kid, Richard, reading a story about a researcher who said that there was a spacecraft orbiting our planet that came from the Epsilon Bootes. Is it the star system?
It was Duncan Lunan.
That's right. Exactly. I mean, so it's possible that this is all going on.
Yeah, Duncan was an old friend of mine, and he had figured that out by decoding these time delay echo old-style radio signals going back to the 20s and 30s, and he put them together as a code, and it appeared to give a place, a location, in one of the two Lagrange points, which are equilateral positions in the orbit of the moon, space 60 degrees ahead and 60 degrees behind the moon in its orbit, and he thought, a la what a guy at Stanford named Bracewell many years later thought, that there might be a robotic probe sent by some other civilization to be in the solar system waiting patiently, parked, until humans developed radio and sent out signals, in which case the probe was programmed to respond and, you know, basically open hailing frequencies. And Duncan figured all that out, and then when further work demonstrated that his methodology in mathematics was an error, mm-hmm. he was man enough to actually admit that he had made some errors, and that probably was not what was going on. So, yeah, Duncan Lunan is a real scientist, and he proposed a real testable hypothesis. It was tested and found wanting, and so we move on. What's interesting about the YU-55 thing is the exquisite mathematical linkage, which is so incredibly improbable between it and alanine, the fact that it was only first seen back in 2005, that it was coming through the Earth-Moon system within 200,000 miles the night that Russians launched, ostensibly, their Phobos grunt mission to Mars, which then got stranded in Earth orbit, and then YU-55 continues on out. We have not seen any of the closest data. If you go to the Arecibo website, there's crap there. There's nothing interesting.
No.
The last radar observations that show us something intriguing were from Goldstone one day before, 24 hours before, when this thing was 800 and some thousand miles away, it got four times closer. The signal-to-noise ratio got four squared, 16 times better. So why don't we have stunning radar imagery of YU-55 passing closest to the Earth? Because somebody doesn't want us to see them.
Awesome. So
let me finish the scenario before we get to the top of the hour, because we need to get to Mars. The real MacGuffin here is Mars. What these two nations, actually three, because China is part of the equation.
Are going to.
So what I now have, and I can tell you and the country for the first time tonight, I have some interesting information by way of Vandenberg. Remember Vandenberg?
I remember that little update you gave us.
Remember the night that I did the update and I said that it was bothering a lot of people the night of the YU-55 flyby that Vandenberg was lit up?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a very interesting tale associated. There are two ways that Vandenberg lights up. One is if they're going to launch something. The other is if they're communicating something. What I did not know, at least I certainly didn't know it to the degree that I now know it because I've been briefed, is that Vandenberg is a Western Hemisphere communications clearinghouse for a global network of radio tracking facilities that funnels all that information to an Air Force base that no one even knows exists in Colorado, which I think is Shriver. I'll have to go and check the actual data, but I think it's Shriver. What does Shriver do that makes it really important in this story? It's the one that's controlling the XB-37B. The space plane?
Yes.
The weird reconnaissance vehicle?
That we don't know what it
that
does?
That we're never supposed to know what it's doing, that it leaves on these 270-day missions, goes somewhere, and then comes home and nobody knows what it's doing. Well, what would you say if I was to tell you that the inside information, the analysis now by people who are in a position to, shall we say, speculate with informed speculation, because even they're not in the loop, but they got enough data to kind of put the clues together, that night that YU-55 made its 200,000-mile approach to Earth, the X-37B, actually made a close directed flyby of YU-55 with cameras rolling, CCD cameras.
So they must have some great
pictures.
They
have some superb digital imagery. Now, what's the thing about this mission that has confounded everybody? It never sends a radio signal anywhere.
Right.
It goes up, does something mysterious. There's no telemetry. It's all autonomous. It's all robots on board.
And then comes back.
And then it comes back and brings the data home.
Yeah.
Would you be surprised to know, George, that the latest mission, which launched a few months ago, is coming home remarkably early on December 3rd? And it's not supposed to? And that's bringing something home.
I wonder what it is. I told you Richard would be intriguing tonight. And he is. We'll be back with more with Richard C. Hoagland on Coast to Coast AM.